Accession number 18475, Reel 4.
Arnold Baldwin, Reel 4. You were just saying that you were approaching the hedge and you still couldn't take off.
Yes, and then I got a second call from Dennis, and he sounded quite frantic this time. He said, if you don't lift off shortly, we're going straight through the hedge. Well, I was tugging like mad on the control column, but finally she did just lift, just in the nick of time, and I climbed enough to let Dennis take off. And we went some little distance like this, but the glider was so unstable that the port wing began to dip as soon as we were clear of the ground. And I tried to pick it up using aileron, but it didn't respond. And as it was dipping further, I thought, and we were still fairly close to the ground, I could see the wingtip hitting the ground. I was a bit panicky over that. So I applied full opposite rudder as well as aileron and gradually got this wing to come up to a level position. But I realised that I'd got full right rudder on. And I realised quickly that it meant we got to fly the whole journey like this, because the wretched thing was not rigged properly, overloaded, and was desperately trying to turn on its back. So the other worry that followed from this was that there were two positions to fly a glider behind a tug. What we called the high toe and the low toe. The high toe was the position that you always took off in. But after climbing a bit, it was usual to descend through the tug's slipstream into the low toe position, where there was a blind flying instrument, which we called the angle of dangle, came into operation. And this would enable you, if you got into that position, to fly blind, as it were, behind the tug, because you had an instrument panel there which indicated whether you were in the correct position, either as far as too high or too low, or too far to the left or too far to the right. If you centralised these two bars on this screen, then you could fly anywhere, knowing that you were in the right position. However, I couldn't do this. I dare not go through the slipstream, because I thought the whole thing will turn turtle if I do that. It's so unsteady. And of course, the slipstream is a very bumpy affair as you go through that. And it was quite impossible to do this. Well, after a while, we'd flown a little while, my leg began to ache like hell from the pressure on the rudder bar. So I asked Joe Michie, my co-pilot, if he would jam his foot on the rudder pedal and on his side, because we had dual controls in the gliders. If he would jam his foot on and hold it there to ease mine, which he did. And we seemed to be getting along all right, except that by this time we'd lost communication with the tug. And we were approaching a huge black cumulus cloud. The takeoff time was something like 2 a.m, I think, so that it was the middle of the night, quite dark, especially if the moon became obscured. Well, we were heading right for this huge cloud. And I thought, my God, I hope he's not going to fly through that. Because cumulus clouds are very active clouds, and any aircraft bangs and bounces around inside a cumulus cloud. It's a very bumpy ride indeed. Nobody really likes it. Anyway, I found that I'd got no communication with him at all to ask him if he could avoid the cloud. There was no way I could do it. And he, of course, was unaware of the problems that I was faced with. So he continued on his steady course, which his navigator, of course, had given him the course to fly on. And that was normal practice he was carrying out. Well, we flew into this cloud, and it was the most frightening experience I've ever had before or since, because we banged and bounced and jumped about. I had no idea where the tug was itself. I'd lost all sight of the tug. And I really didn't have too much idea of our own aircraft's attitude, whether I just knew it couldn't be upside down because I'd be hanging on the seatbelt if it was. But I was terribly afraid that it would turn turtle. And of course, I kept, Joe and I both had our foot on the right rudder pedal to try and keep the wing up. Well, after quite a time inside this cloud, I don't know how long, it was quite a horrifying time, we suddenly broke through the cloud, and there was the tug, curiously enough, just where it should be, ahead of me, in the right position, in the moonlight. I thought, oh, great. But then, almost immediately, there was a sudden jerk, and I thought, oh dear, what now? And then the inevitable had happened. The tug rope had finally snapped, and I could see the tug receding from me and going away from me fast. And I thought, well, what the hell? We've got a broken tow rope now. And I was so despondent because after what had been months and months of training, and especially the last few weeks of intensive training, as it were, I was really attuned in my whole body, my mind and everything. I was going to be in France when I came down. That's how I felt. And suddenly all that had gone, and here I was somewhere still over England, and I've had it. I won't even reach France. And I felt so sad and so miserable and frustrated and unhappy that I just sat there and thought, oh, nothing. I just didn't want to know anymore. And I said to my co-pilot, my exact words were, I said, Joe, I don't give a fuck what happens now. Well, I had a good co-pilot. And he said, with great feeling, well, I do, he said. And I expect all those blokes in the back do as well. And that sort of brought me up with a jolt. I thought, what a stupid thing to say. And I thought, now where do we go? What do we do? Because it was still quite dark again. You were either in fairly bright light, or suddenly the moon was obscured by another cloud and you didn't see anything more again. And then I noticed down below my starboard wingtip, aerodrome lights. I thought, it's something unexpected, I must say. We're all right, we can land on an aerodrome, thank God for that, because we would have had a frightful pile-up if we'd landed in the dark anywhere without knowing where we were, what we were hitting. To see an aerodrome there was like going, oh. Well, a reprieve from a death sentence, really. And I thought, oh, this is a piece of cake. And so I started to estimate, because I had quite a lot of night flying experience, and the thing was, though, that just before this, I'd looked at my airspeed indicator, and it had said, I think, 140 miles an hour. Which was much too fast. We normally landed a glider at about 80. And I'd slightly eased back on the stick to kill the speed, but it hadn't worked. The next time I looked at it, not too long afterwards, we were still doing 140. And I realised that something had gone wrong. The airspeed indicator and the altimeter operate through what is known as the pitot head, which was fixed above the cockpit. And this, it seemed to me, must have been broken by the broken tow rope. And it wasn't working. Well, at the... with such an overload, I dare not try to kill the speed anymore by pulling back on the stick, because I was certain that if I did that, I'd stall the aircraft altogether. So I couldn't do anything other than just fly it at the attitude it was, and try and judge my approach and landing on this airfield at the present inclination of the plane. Well, I made... normally, if you approach an airfield, you have what you call a downwind leg. You're going in the opposite direction to which you want to land, really. You go the downwind leg, then you turn crosswind, then you turn back into wind to make your landing, which is normal practice, is to land into the wind and not down the wind. So I made these turns as I thought, but having made one turn, I found that the lights went out on the aerodrome, and my first thought was that they must be engaged in operations. They'd seen us and didn't want us to land in there because it might foul up the operations they were taking part in. But I thought, well, I've no choice. I've got to go in there. Anyway, without any landing lights, I wasn't too certain of my approach at all. And I was very relieved to find that when we were almost down, we were flying between two hangars. How the hell we missed one or the other, I don't know. But fairly soon we touched down, not on a runway, but bumping along on grass. And I had a momentary loss of concentration, which is why it's always as well to have two pilots instead of one in situations like this, because Joe quickly applied the brakes, which I'd failed to do. And we ran on for quite a long way, bumping along on this grass, till finally we stopped. And we got out. I could see the broken end of the tow rope on the ground. It was still quite dark, of course. And we walked back to the control tower to report there. And I was going to ask them why they put the lights out on the runway, and they beat me to the punch by saying, why did you land downwind? And I realised then that the normal type of paraffin flare that we were used to in training was visible through 360 degrees. But the electric lights on runways was hooded light, and it was only visible if you were making the correct interwind approach. If you were making a wrong approach, as I was, then the light was hooded on that side and you didn't see it. An indication to anybody in a powered aircraft to go round again because they were coming in the wrong way. Anyway, that showed me that I had been landing downwind anyway, when they told me so. I then phoned to the commander glider pilots, Brigadier Chatterton. Or was he Colonel Chatterton then? I'm not sure. But I had to phone him at his headquarters and tell him that we were down. They told me it was Odium in Hampshire where I'd landed. And I had to phone Chataway and tell him, and he sounded a bit, none too pleased. And we returned eventually in the morning. When the light came up again, we went and had a look at the glider, and the state it was in was something that I could hardly believe looking at it. The tow ropes had a yoke at the glider end of the tow rope, and the two ends of the yoke fitted underneath the main planes either side of the cockpit. And then the two came together some good few feet ahead of the cockpit, and then it was a single rope back to the tug. Well, obviously before the rope had broken, we must have been diving. I think sometimes we might even have been ahead of the tug, or diving steeply downwards, or I don't know quite what happened. Later, when I spoke to the tug pilot back in the on the aerodrome, Dennis, I said, you must have had a rough ride, Dennis. He said, I've never had one like that before. He said, there were times when I was literally standing on my tail. So I know that I was plunging downwards, and I pulled him. I was going in front of him, actually, I think, so that as I went in front, it pulled his tail right down. And he was quite a strong man. I'd flown with him as a passenger in Albemarle's and in Halifax's, which we were flying, he was flying now. And he used to exert tremendous pressure on the control column. He would wrap his arms round the wheel just to do a very tight turn, just to give me a bit of a thrill when I was up there with him. And he would lock his arms round the stick and he would yank it back. I thought he would tear the wings off the aircraft the way he used to do it, but obviously he knew what he was doing. And it was that kind of practice he'd had like that, and the strength that he'd got there, that must have saved the day for him, because he must have had to fight that aircraft something incredibly difficult. Anyway, the actual two yokes of the tow rope we found in the morning had cut right through the front part of the wings on either side of the cockpit. Right, the hawsers, of course, were plywood construction, and it had cut right through the plywood, right back to the main spar of the main plane. And then it had gone back overhead, it had smashed, as I realised must have happened, it had smashed the pitot head quite flat. That's why we had no airspeed and no altimeter working. Anyway, it then looped itself round the fuselage. Fortunately, it missed the tailplane and the elevator altogether, and it trailed along on the grass behind us. If it had continued wrapping itself round as it had been doing, and wrapped round the elevator as well, then we'd have gone straight in. There would have been no way for it. So that was another little miracle. I had very mixed feelings in the end. I cursed my bad luck for having such a rotten glider, for having an overloaded glider. Generally, the final preparations that seemed to be going so very well, suddenly had all gone to pieces, and I thought, well, that's the sort of luck I would have. I was really sick with misery over that. And then afterwards, of course, I began to reflect, well, there's two sorts of luck, and you must admit you had some good luck when you saw that airfield there. You had some good luck when you flew in quite blind between two hangars and missed them both. So it wasn't all bad luck. Some of it was good luck. Since then, I've been made an honorary member of the 9th Battalion of the Parachute Regiment's Reunion Club, as they call it. And Joe and I have both been made honorary members. We've attended their annual dinners. I attend every one now regularly. They made a considerable fuss of us. I was quite overwhelmed by it. The first one I went to, one of the senior officers read an extract from my report of it in our magazine. Read quite a large extract of my account of what had happened. And they treat us with tremendous respect and enthusiasm. And I think it's a shame, because of the three gliders involved with the 9th Battalion, Joe and I are the only survivors. The other two gliders had difficulties, but they both got... One got within a few hundred yards of the battery and took part in the assault. The other one landed about 3 miles away. They had difficulties too with the chute, the arrestor chute opening when it shouldn't do, and various failures, mechanical failures of that sort, had made it very difficult for them, but they did get there. However, the pilot of one, Dickie Kerr, was killed just a few months later at Arnhem, and Stanley Bone, who was the oldest of any of us, we used to call him a grand old English gentleman because he was quite bald-headed. He sort of disappeared. He didn't turn up to any of our reunions. And then we heard a story from some source, so I don't know that anybody ever verified it, but somebody brought the story to a reunion that Stanley Bone had died 2 or 3 years ago. The fact is, of course, that they were the two fellows that the 9th Battalion should have been able to make such a fuss of, because they did get, in the end, to the battery or near to it. And the fact that Joe and I, who, in Joe's words, were the earliest people to invade England on the morning of 6th of June, we are made such a fuss of. But On the other hand, we did get them down without injury, and we might have killed all 30 if we'd done it wrong. And it's that that gives them such a high regard for us, something I've got to feel proud of. And I have a great time with them. I have friends now that I see regularly in the 9th Battalion. And of course, I've all my old pals in the Glider Pilot Regiment. We meet at least once every year for a dinner. Interestingly, I had two letters came with the same mail last Thursday morning. One was from an old glider pilot friend of mine in Ireland, and the other one ditto from Canada, and they both arrived on the mat at identical times, which is very heartwarming, really. I've still got to reply to them. That's not still running, is it?